Okay, I'm pretty sure we're on a double check on. Nope, we're still good. We're recording. Okay. Well, my name is Kevin McClatchy, and this is part of the Rock Voices Oral History Project. And today we're very happy to have Robert J. Watson to do an interview with us. Dr. Watson, can you give us some biographical information, your full name, the year you were born, where you're from originally, and your education?
Okay, well, thank you. And thank you very much, Kevin, for allowing me to be involved in this project. First of all, Robert J., J-A-Y, middle name, Watson, and date of birth, January 26. 1949. And where from originally? I was born in Newcastle, Jameson Hospital, but have lived almost all my life in Slippery Rock. I grew up on Franklin Street in the village of Slippery Rock. And my education, I went to McKay Education Building for kindergarten through sixth grade. That was referred to as the lab school at the time. And I did all of my primary education and elementary education in the McKay Education Building from kindergarten through sixth. I then went to what was referred as the new high school, which is the current high school just across the road from us this morning. It was referred to as the new high school because prior to that time, the high school for Slippery Rock was in what is now Caruth Riza Hall, and it then moved to the back wing of McKay Education Building. So I graduated from Slippery Rock Area High School in 1966. And like so many young people growing up in Slippery Rock and going on to college, there was an interest to do that elsewhere other than Slippery Rock State College. So I was pretty set to go to Penn State. A few of my friends were attending, and there were two gentlemen who were very instrumental in changing my mind. One was Murray Shelburne, who was a family friend and who lived on Elm Street in Slippery Rock. And to me, he was the consummate out-of-doors man. He was the real person who lived his life outside and enjoyed nature and the animals and plants therein. And he said to me one day, I was working at Wilson's Filling Station downtown, which is now part of the Sheets facility, but Ray Wilson owned that building on the corner of Franklin and Main Street. And I pumped gas and washed windows and changed tires and did all that as a high school kid. And Murray Shelburne said to me one day, somebody said you're going to Penn State. I said, yes, I am. He said, why? And I stopped and I said, well, it's good school. He said, yes, you told me a while back that you wanted to study biology. And I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, why are you going to Penn State to study biology? We have an excellent biology program right here in your hometown. He said, don't overlook that, Bob. And that started me thinking. And that Sunday in church at the United Methodist Church, one of the gentlemen who was very active in the church was Jim Egley, who was a professor of physical education and also soccer coach and swimming coach. And he said to me after church, you're going to Slippery Rock, aren't you? And I said, well, I didn't think I was. Mr. Shelgren started me to think a little bit more about that. He said, well, you've always called yourself an athlete. And he said, I know you've earned letters in two or three sports there at the high school. And he said, if you're any kind of athlete, he said, you might want to try out for the men's soccer team. But he said, if you're not an athlete, then I don't want you trying out. And he kind of put that little bit of guilt on my conscience. And over the next week or two, I changed my mind to go to Slippery Rock University. And I played on Jim Egli's soccer team, and my first academic advisor and my advisor through my 4 years undergraduate study was Murray Shelgren, the man who helped me understand the quality of program, the quality program that Slippery Rock State College then at the time had in biology. And boy, did I get my eyes opened up, because I graduated from a high school that was basically teaching anatomy and physiology as part of biology. And I didn't know what was going on the first semester at Slippery Rock when my first biology teacher, who was Murph Shelgren, started talking about DNA and RNA and protein synthesis. And I thought, what is all of this? I took biology one and biology two in high school and earned very good grades. And I'd never heard these terms. So it started a new career in so many ways for me. And I was blessed to have wonderful professors. There are not many my professors, unfortunately, alive today, but Tom Gaither is. And I see Tom when we're able to attend church together. He was a wonderful influence on my life as well. So I did my undergraduate at Slippery Rock in 1970, graduated, and then moved away for a couple of years in the Baltimore area. I taught in the Anne Arundel County Schools at Linthicum Area High School, just about 6 miles south of city center Baltimore, and right inside Anne Arundel County. And I lived in Linthicum and taught high school students from grades 8 through 12 in biology, and also taught some chemistry as well, which was my minor and undergraduate study. And at the same time, I did graduate work at Johns Hopkins University in the city. After 2 years, earned my master's degree at Hopkins. And I was going to school full time in the summer, as well as managing a tennis country club and a country club in Linthicum. And then on weekends, I also was a lifeguard in Ocean City, Maryland. So I was juggling all of that. And in my last semester at Hopkins, I got a phone call from a friend of mine and said, you know, Slippery Rock's looking for somebody to work in the admissions and records office. And that might be something you'd be interested in. And I said, oh, no, that's fine. I just completed certification for guidance and counseling. And I've been given a new position in a brand new high school at a place called Fort Meade, Maryland. And I'm going to be a senior class counselor in this brand new high school. And I said, I'm very excited about that, but that's nice that you would think I might be interested in the position at Slippery Rock, but I'm not. Thank you very much. And so A couple weeks went by and I got another phone call, and this time from a different person. And I knew right away that that individual had spoken with the first person with whom I had conversation. And he pretended he hadn't, but said, you know, there's a new position at Slippery Rock, and you'd get a chance to work in admissions and records, and you'd work with transfer students and new freshmen and so on. And that might be something you'd really enjoy, because you, as an undergraduate, worked in several offices, and you were active in student government, you were a class president, you were an athlete, you did all these things as an undergraduate. You could share that in this new position. And I said, oh no, thank you very much, but I'm actually going to be a senior counselor at Fort Meade High School. And it was probably then, about the end of May, that I got a call from Bob Lowry, who, as fate would have it, was the interim president here at Slippery Rock. Bob was the first director of admissions at Slippery Rock University, and he came from Kane High School, and where he was principal, and moved to Slippery Rock as the first director of admissions, and happened to be, for my benefit, he happened to be a neighbor. And so I grew up mowing the lawn and shoveling the walk and the driveway and doing odd jobs for Bob and Donna, who were just wonderful people and wonderful neighbors. And Bob Lowry then called me and said, Bob, I understand you've been informed of this position that's coming on at Slippery Rock, and it's a new position, and it might give you an opportunity to come back to the area. And he said, if you want to go on for doctoral study, you could apply for admission to the University of Pittsburgh, where Bob had done his PhD. And I told Bob the same thing I had told the other two people, that I had accepted this new position as a senior counselor, and I was so excited about that and so on. And he said, well, promise me one thing. He said, it's Friday. He said, promise me that you'll think about this over the weekend and that you'll call me on Monday. And he said, I've gotten to know you fairly well, and I think you would enjoy this job, but it needs to be a decision that you make. Well, I thought a great deal about it over the weekend. I actually called my mother and father and talked with them. And to this day, Kevin, I'm not actually sure why I changed my mind. But frankly, I thought a lot about it. I prayed a lot about it. And when I called Bob Lowry on Monday, I said, can you tell me a little more about this job? And 30 days later, I had applied. I was interviewed and offered a position. And that started my career in July of 1972 at Slippery Rock University. For the next 6 or 7 years, I attended University of Pittsburgh in the doctoral study in higher education administration. My dissertation topic was ironically a topic of historical significance to me, and history was not something I really enjoyed in high school, and I can say that because I don't think any of my history teachers are still alive, but it was not exciting to me. It was boring, and it was so far in the past. And ironically, I was tuned into and turned on to history by a man by the name of Richard Seckinger at the University of Pittsburgh, who was a former secretary of the Pennsylvania Historical Society, a wonderful man. And he taught the very first course that all doc students took in their first semester, and that was history of higher education. And I thought, oh my heavens, this is going to be a sleeper. I'm really going to have a tough time with this. And in the first day, Richard K. Seckinger walked through the door without one book, one note, without anything except the roll. He called the roll and he began to open my mind to history. And generally, history of higher education, specifically history of this great university that we're a part of at Slippery Rock. And my first research paper was the history of higher education at Slippery Rock. And I don't know whether Dr. Seckinger was truthful when he said I had done a good job in my primary resource and research and writing, or whether he was trying to get another person into the fold of history of higher ed. I used to joke with him about that, but in my research that very first semester in the fall of 1972, I learned that my family had been very much involved in the founding of this place. And I had heard that at family gatherings at Christmas and Easter and Thanksgiving. And my grandmother would talk about, your great-grandfather was involved as a businessman in Slippery Rock. He owned the general store in a building that is now Elephant Number 8 Thai Cuisine in Slippery Rock on Main Street. And my great-granddad and his business partner, Mr. Williams, built that building. And so my grandmother would say, oh yeah, your great-grandfather was very involved, and that was the end of the discussion. She really didn't know a great deal about it other than he was involved. And frankly, most of the people in the family knew less than she did. So as I got into the original minutes of the stockholders before the institution was founded, lo and behold, I see this John Nelson Watson, and he was involved as one of the three men who traveled to Clarion to investigate this new project in Pennsylvania called a normal school at Clarion, Pennsylvania. And he came back and reported to the other stockholders that this was something that we could do at Slippery Rock. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. Yeah. That's great. And so the long story short there is the next 6 or 7 years, whenever I could do a historically related research topic in any of my classes at Pitt, I did that. I then graduated in the spring of 1979. And so the 1970s were a decade of higher education for Bob Watson, with a bachelor's degree in 70, a master's in 72, and a doctorate in 79. So probably more than you wondered about my education.
No, that's great. I mean, you know, we have those trustee minute meetings right here in the archives. And sure enough, I see Watson's name in there, and it's, yeah, and it must have been amazing for you to see it yourself.
Oh, it was. It really was. I'd mention one other person who was a wonderful person and a leader to this institution, and that was Leela Vincent, who was the wife of A.P.
You know what, Bob? This microphone is fading out a little bit here. Maybe if you could come closer to the screen or the...
Oh, sure.
I think it's actually in the webcam. Okay.
I'd like to mention one other person who helped me understand my family's involvement in the university development, and that was Leila Vincent. And Leila was married to Arthur P. Vincent, who, after whom Vincent Science Hall is named. AP was, as he was known in the village and on the campus, AP was a mathematics, physics, chemistry professor, and he was also an athletic coach. He and N. Kerr Thompson were coaches together for many, many years. And Leila Vincent happened to be married name Watson, and she was my father's cousin and living as I was growing up in the village. And so I knew Aunt Leila and actually mowed her lawn and shoveled her walk and so on and so forth. She lived right next door to Bob and Donna Lowry on Center Street Extension in a beautiful stone home that still exists today. And so as I started my work at Pitt, I went to Aunt Leila and I asked her a number of questions about the involvement of the Watson family. And Leila, for many years, was a member of the Council of Trustees at Slippery Rock State Teachers College and then State College. And she was personal friends with Emma Guffey Miller. And Leila, although a very staunch conservative, and Emma Guffey Miller, a very staunch liberal, they were close personal friends and social friends. And so Leila would be able to provide me with a great deal of information and artifacts. Emma Guffey Miller had given her information, some photographs and different things like that. But Aunt Leila also had a number of artifacts herself, the overwhelming majority of which now reside in the archives. But she was a person who helped me a great deal understand the development of the institution and the involvement of the Watson family.
Right. Maybe to get back to your experience as an undergrad here. What were your first impressions when you got here and, you know, you made this decision to come to the campus? I'm sure you were aware of what the campus looked like from, you know, being from the town, but if you could speak to that.
Sure. I thought, like so many Slippery Rock kids, we were referred to by the college students as townies. If you grew up in Slippery Rock, you were a townie. And I thought, like so many townies, we knew the university. Because on Saturdays, if it was raining and it was the fall, winter, or spring, we would find Lucky, who was the night watchman, Ken Luckett. We'd find him on campus somewhere, and he'd open West Gym for us. And we were probably 12, 13, 14 years old, and we would go in and play basketball in West Gym. And that was the original West Gym that had a second floor banked running track, which when the West Gym was built originally in 1906, it was identified as the most advanced, most modern physical education facility known in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And so as young boys, we'd take advantage and we would hoist our bicycles up to the second floor using climbing ropes, and we'd get on the bank track, and we would have our miniature basic Tour de France on the second floor of the bike track. And I do remember one of my friends broke his arm one day and that ended the bike race a little early. But we just enjoyed the facilities. I mean, as a townsperson, I was growing up in a time that there were maybe 1,500 students, at the most 2,000. So I knew all the buildings, knew all the facilities, and knew many of the faculty and staff. I sat in church with many of those people. Some of them were my Sunday school teachers. When I worked at Wilson's Filling Station at the Sunoco service station there and pump gas, I'd pump gas and meet faculty and staff on a regular basis. There was no division in any way between campus and community. It was a truly a merging of those individuals who were a part of the institution because of employment. They were also very much a part of the community for their social engagement as well. So I thought I knew Slippery Rock, and frankly, I was very mistaken because I knew it from the perspective of a 12-year-old or 10-year-old or 14-year-old just enjoying the facilities or sneaking under the tarp at the football games on at Thompson Field there adjacent to Keister Road. And Pop Store was the athletic director at the time, and Pop would see us walking down the road while the football game was on, and we were not doing much other than kicking rocks down the road, and Pop would say, "Boys, would you like to see the football game?" "Oh, would we ever, Pop? We'd love to see the football game." So he'd say, "Okay, I can't give you a ticket to get in because we have to count the tickets and everything, but I'll pull up the tarpaulin and you slide right underneath and then you can watch the football game." And so we did that. That was part of our life. That was part of growing up. I think I remember a picture of myself that my father took. It was in the winter. I believe it had just been my birthday, and one of my birthday presents was a Slippery Rock sweatshirt, and it says Slippery Rock 19 ? And I still have that picture, and as far as I'm concerned, it's a prophetic picture because indeed it allowed me to understand that. But I didn't know the campus. And when I got involved as a freshman, I was overwhelmed. And my parents were not wealthy by any stretch. My dad was a rural mailman, and my mom worked in the cooperative activities office here on campus as a secretary. And then she rose to the rank of business manager for her last several years. And I knew the institution. My dad was a 1940 alum, and I knew through his eyes, I knew through my mom's eyes as being an employee at co-op. But as I got involved as a new freshman, I had to work two jobs to help pay for my tuition and other expenses. And so my first job was working in the bookstore, hauling books and doing whatever the bookstore manager wanted me to do. And my second job really allowed me an understanding of the campus, because I worked for a woman by the name of Connie Stevenson. And Connie Stevenson was the manager of the grill, which we didn't have a student union at the time in 1966. We had the Hut, which is now part of the art building complex. And the Hut was a place where you could go and play cards. The bottom level the ground level of the hut was a bowling alley, and you could actually go in and bowl duck pins, as we called them there at the time. And at the one end, adjacent to Rhodes Hall of the hut, was the grill. And you could get hamburgers, hot dogs, French fries, fresh made milkshakes, all of those things of the 1950s, 60s era. And Connie Stevenson was in charge of the hut and the grill. And so I applied for a position. I was Connie's paper boy for many years, from the time I was 12 until I was 17. I delivered papers all throughout the town, and gave me another way to meet faculty and staff. But Connie was on my paper route, and she lived on Keister Road. And so when I applied for a job, she hired me. And I flipped hamburgers and made French fries and made hot dogs. And
I didn't realize, huh?
Did all those kinds of things. And I can remember as President Carter would come in and get a cup of coffee or whatever. Connie Stevenson, even though I was a brand new freshman, low on the totem pole, she would say, "Now, President Carter, I want you to meet this young man. You're going to need to know him. This is Bob Watson. And Bob, this is the president of the college, President Carter." And anybody who came through the hut and the grill, Connie would introduce me to. So I became involved my very first year in student government, that continued on.
As a freshman, yeah.
As a freshman, that continued on. My junior year, I was class president and in student government as well. And I played soccer in the fall for Jim Egley. And my first spring semester, I played golf on the golf team for Hank Barrel. And after that, I played on the tennis team for my sophomore, junior, and senior year. And tennis was the sport that I enjoyed greatly. But my experience, I really did not know Slippery Rock and all that it has to offer, all that it had to offer at the time. I thought I did, but I was very, very wrong in that. But it opened my life, my world, in so many ways. I was active in a social fraternity, Alpha Chi Rho. I pledged my second semester freshman year, and my parents thought that would be my ultimate demise, and that I would turn into something I was not by joining a social fraternity. But back in the 60s, social fraternities were extremely popular socially. And that was, if you weren't involved in a social fraternity, your social life was not as much as it could be, let me say that. But I enjoyed being chaplain of our social fraternity. At the same time, I was social chairman. And that might appear as a conflict of interest to some, but as I used to say, I would bless the parties before they started. So we always had a good time.
You know what? Can we take a break right now? Because I think every once in a while you fade out a little bit. And I thought maybe I could adjust the volume on your okay. end.
Yeah, I'm speaking fairly loud.
I'm going to pause this right now.
Okay.
We're back. Sorry for the interruption. We're back on recording now. So, we were talking about your undergraduate years and the hut and the experience there and meeting all the people. And then your involvement with the SGA and some teachers. Could you say were the most influential teachers for you when you were here?
That's an excellent question. And frankly, at my age, Kevin, I've thought a lot about that over the years because there are different times that in my life that certain teachers would remind me, in a sense, of the importance of what I learned in their classroom. And it was always important that I learned the discipline that they were teaching, the subject they were teaching. But there were so many professors, teachers who taught me so much more than the subject matter. And one clearly, easily comes to mind in the biology department. That was Richard Medvey, who passed away here a few years ago. And Dick Medvey was a person who was a no-frills kind of person and a no-nonsense kind of person. And Dick Medvey would strive on a regular basis to consistently increase the quality of education that biology majors were receiving. And he taught a number of different courses, but one of his most famous courses was a summer class in field botany. And Dick was also the biology professor who placed you into your student teaching assignment if you were going to earn a certification in biology, teaching certification. You had to basically go through the gate of Dick Medvey. And his gate was pretty narrow. And he did not want someone bearing the letters Slippery Rock State College to do anything less than an outstanding job in the public schools while student teaching. And so he would meet with the biology majors who were planning on earning a certification in your sophomore year, in your junior year, long before you student taught. And he would talk about the importance of you knowing the subject matter. You must know the subject matter. And then it was understood among the biology majors that there was a pecking order in terms of placement into certain high schools. There were some high schools, keep in mind, in the late 1960s, this whole innovative biology curriculum developed called Biological Sciences Curriculum Study, BSCS. That was the big wave. They had a cellular approach to BSCS. They had a biochemistry approach to BSCS. They had an environmental approach. So it depended on whether you had the gold curriculum, the green curriculum, the blue curriculum, as to what emphasis you were going to be teaching in the public high schools. But this curriculum just was brand new. And if you were going to go into a high school that was teaching BSCS, you had to be really on top of your game and you had to know what was going on in the biology world. So Dick Medvey would teach this field botany class, and the only time you could take it was the summer. And we learned after we went through the rigors of the class that this was one of the hoops Dick had created to determine what level you were in your ability to understand the discipline, and then how that would play a role in where he was going to place you. He might place you in a high school that was still teaching anatomy and physiology as biology, and that was usually where you did not want to be, because it wasn't where the biology field was going. And so in order to get placed into a BSc as curriculum high school, you had to really, really work hard. So the summer before my senior year, I registered to take field botany. And on the first day, keep in mind, this was a pre-session class. And at the time, we had pre-session 3 weeks, regular session 6 weeks, post-session 3 weeks. And in order to find the plant specimens that Dick wanted the students to find in the field, he had to teach this in pre-session when there were still a lot of the spring wildflowers out and the wild orchids and the trillium and so many of the beautiful plants native to Western Pennsylvania. He had to teach it in pre-session. So the first day of a three-week class, now 3 weeks, 5 days a week, it had 15 classes. And those classes started at 8 o'clock in the morning and they ended at 12. But that's not when your work ended. That's when the class ended. Your work had just begun. And so he required the identification and memorization of 250 wild plants in Western Pennsylvania. And you had to learn, first of all, the identification of 250, and then you had to learn the genus, the species, and the common name. So you had to learn 750 words, 250 genus, 250 species, 250 common names. And you had 3 weeks to do it, and you had to collect 50 subjects, 50 specimens. You had to preserve them the way he wanted preserved. You had to present them the way he wanted them presented. And then the biology faculty would review them. It was not just Dick, but he shared them with the entire faculty. So my good fortune was I knew Slippery Rock State College campus. I knew the Gerlach or Garlow Farm like the back of my hand. I knew the Sportsman's Club. I knew A.P. Vincent's Farm. I knew K.O. Reed's Farm. I know all of these farms in and around the area. And when I learned that this particular type of sphagnum moss was growing in an area that would have about this much moisture and on a south-facing slope, I knew I could go to Redmond Bottom and find that sphagnum moss, and that helped me immensely. But for 3 weeks, I never worked so hard. And the last week was the crunch. The last week in this three-week class to memorize those 750 terms. And I could not do it at home. I had to do it in a lab. So we had 4 hours of class. At noon, I stayed. And then the science hall was closed at 9 o'clock at night. He had all the specimens there for you to memorize. And I figured, I can't do this. I cannot get the A I have to get in this class by going home and sleeping. So I brought I smuggled a sleeping bag into Vincent Science Hall and I put it in the janitor's closet. And at 9 o'clock, when they locked up the Vincent Science Hall, I was inside. And I got my sleeping bag out, but I studied at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, sometimes by a flashlight as the night watchman or police would come by. But then I would sleep in the sleeping bag. I'd get up in the morning before class began at 8. I'd roll up the sleeping bag, put it in the janitor's closet, and I was dressed in the same clothes I had the day before, but that was just what I needed to do. And I will never forget when I took the final examination and scored very highly, Dick Medved called me into his office and he said, "Watson, I think you showed me something in this 3-week class." He said, "I'm going to place you at North Hills High School." He said, "That's the best placement we have for a biology student teacher." He said, "I don't want you to embarrass yourself or this institution." He said, "You go out, you do well." And he said, "It will serve you well for the rest of your life." Now, it was the best placement because you were assigned to two former Slippery Rock University biology majors who were Walter Shinko. And Walter Shinko was a 1958, 57 graduate, but knew Dick Medved very well. And so everything was all set up that the best Slippery Rock student teacher would, or one of the best, would get a chance to go to North Hills High School. And it was that assignment that Hank Molitor and Walter Shinko were my two cooperating teachers. Very demanding, but I knew when I finished in May of 1970, my undergraduate work and graduated, I knew I was ready to teach students in the discipline of biology. And it came with this emphasis that my faculty member, my teacher, my professor, my mentor, Dick Medved, instilled in me. And there were just so many people like that. Dick Medved was one of those. I took a class that was supposed to be an elective, and I thought, oh no, this is not. It was world geography, and I thought, oh, world geography, okay. Well, I was a junior. I walked into world geography, and this man came in, and he began talking, and I couldn't understand him. I had such a difficult time understanding him. And he would refer to places like Suthdakata. And Suthdakata. And I kept, what is Suthdakata? I found out it was South Dakota. All these other names that the gentleman was Hungarian, but he was born and raised behind the Iron Curtain. And he knew Johnny Weissmuller, who was the original Tarzan in the movie. Right. But this gentleman's name was Carlman Bognar. And Carlman Bognar, for anyone who ever had Dr. Bognar, it changed your life. You realized what freedom was because in with the world geography, he would talk about swimming a river to safety and freedom. And you learned so much. I want to share one more. A woman who really changed my life. A woman who just taught me so much more than calculus. And in my freshman year, I, as a biology major and chemistry minor, I was assigned to take calculus. And I went in, and the professor's name was Su Shen Sa, a Chinese woman who very accidentally found herself in Slippery Rock. But I walked in the first day, and she began speaking very much in a Chinese accent. And I had not, in my undergraduate or my high school career, I had never heard a person speak with a Chinese accent. I was born and raised in Slippery Rock, and there were not many Chinese people in the 1950s and early 60s in Slippery Rock, if any. And Professor Saw began the class like, let X equal sine of tangent y. No. Let X equal cosine of y. And I am trying to imitate her dialect at the time that I would hear, and I had no idea. I was having a difficult time learning calculus, but learning calculus with this strong Chinese dialect was difficult for me. And like a typical 17-year-old, I was 17 my first semester freshman year. And like at most 17-year-olds, I thought, this is crazy. This is, you know, so what do immature 17-year-old men, males, often do? They make fun of things. If they can't do it, if they can't learn it, they oftentimes mock it. And that's what I did. As a 17-year-old first semester freshman, I chose the low road in life. And that, I'm ashamed to say that, Kevin, that that's what I did. And in the first 3 weeks, I thought, this is crazy. After class, I would talk with my buddies about, well, you can't understand her. She doesn't even know what she's teaching. How in the world does she know? We can't even tell what she's teaching. And the very first assessment came at the end of the first 3 weeks. And I remember vividly, I earned a 37% in my first calculus test. 37%. I had gone through math at Slippery Rock High School, and it was one of my strengths. Now, I was attempting to learn a theoretical math calculus, but I was spending more time on mocking the teacher than I was learning the subject. And when I earned a 37%, Professor Saw said, if you did not get the grade you wanted in the very strong Chinese dialect or accent, come and see me. Well, that was a changing point for Bob Watson's life. I took several deep breaths, knocked on her office door in what is now Carruth Risa, which was West Hall at the time, and very embarrassed, I went in and asked Professor Saw for help. And I said, I've always done well in mathematics, and I don't know why I got a 37%, a typical 17-year-old freshman. Oh, it couldn't be me. It has to be somebody else who's the problem here. And I said, I don't want to get a 37%. I need to do well because I have to pass this class for my biology and chemistry requirements. And I don't want to earn a 37%. She looked at me and she said, Mr. Watson, I recommend you spend more time on calculus and less time making fun of me.
Wow.
She knew how she spoke. She knew there were immature people mocking her. And thank heavens, she took me under her wing, even though I did not deserve it, clearly did not deserve it. she took me under her wing and she tutored me 3 days a week.
Wow. An
hour each day. And in that period of time, over the next 15 weeks, because we had 18-week semesters at that point in time, you studied for 18 weeks. Christmas vacation was not the end of the fall semester. You came back in January and took your final exams from the fall semester. And so for 15 weeks, Professor Saw tutored me. And she helped me understand calculus. But more importantly than calculus, she helped me understand a person different from me. And I learned one day when I said, Professor Saw, how did you ever get to Slippery Rock? I mean, you're the only Chinese person in Slippery Rock. You're the only Chinese person I know. She went on to tell me that she had an interview at a very prestigious Ivy League school in New England, and she was driving from Texas up to New England for her interview. When this is just at the time Interstate 79 was beginning to open up, and there were segments or sections of 79 you could travel on as an interstate. And she was on Interstate 79 and her car overheated and had a major problem on Interstate 79 near the Slippery Rock exit. So Frankie McConnell at Wilson Service Station, where I ended up pumping gas, went out and towed her in. And she had an older automobile and parts were not readily available. So it was going to be 4 or 5 days before her parts could come in and her car would be repaired. And she said, so she ended up staying in a motel room, and or actually it was, I think at the time she told me that there was someone who gave her accommodation in their home. And so she stayed 4 or 5 days in Slippery Rock and had to call ahead and say she had to postpone or cancel her interview because of her car breaking down and so on. And she ended up telling me that while she was in Slippery Rock, she walked to the campus from downtown and she found the math department and talked with people in the math department. And ironically, we had a opening in the math department for a mathematician. Now, I said to Mrs. Saw, well, where were you working? What were you doing? Were you working at a university before you came to Slippery Rock? And she said, I was working in a brand new business, a brand new organization. And she said, I was a programmer.
Oh.
And she said, no. I took Mrs. Saw's class in 1966. I said, well, what is a programmer? And it was all, at that point in time, it was all about Fortran and COBOL and the beginning of computer science, very much the beginning. But she was a programmer for a company called Texas Instruments.
Oh, yeah, right.
And she explained what she did. She explained that she liked Slippery Rock, the nice small town. She explained that people were friendly, and she explained that she liked the math department. And so she said, I was offered a job and I decided to stay. But Professor Su Sen Sha Sa was one of those extremely instrumental people in my life. And she taught me that people who were different from me, there was not a right or a wrong. It was difference. And we have come to use the term diversity in the last 30 to 40 years. But in 1966, Mrs. Saw, or Professor Saw, was very different from me. And that's the first time I had confronted someone who is different. And she helped me immensely in that regard. She actually was one of my favorite teachers. She was one of my mentors. And not so much in the field of mathematics, but in the field of life. And she attended my college graduation at my request, and she helped me a great deal. She was a wonderful woman, and I would go in and sit in her office, never with an appointment or anything like that. Just go in and crash and sit and talk with her about her life and about my life, and just a wonderful person. But I had so many good people like that, Kevin, who really pulled me up by my bootstraps and taught me right from wrong and helped me understand that the world is much, much, much greater than Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania. And I was going to learn that over the next several years, but they helped me understand that. They helped me jumpstart into that mindset. So Professor Saw was one of those other people. I didn't mean to be so long.
Nice story. Maybe we should move on to, I mean, you went out to Baltimore, and then you mentioned earlier you came here to get to take a position. It was at admissions. What did you do after admissions?
I was assigned at admissions and records. Joseph Marks, who is still living, Joe Marks was our former registrar for years and director of summer school and so on. Joe Marks actually hired me. And I kid Joe and Ramona, who are both still living today in their 90s, I kid them about I was Joe's greatest mistake in life when he chose to hire me for his assistant. But I worked in the records office and also worked directly with transfer students coming into admissions. That was my initial responsibility. And my second year, we opened an area which in room 108 Old Main is now, I believe, the Council of Trustees meeting room, the Robert Marcus room. That was my first office. And we actually opened an area referred as academic services. It was the first effort by the Division of Academic Affairs to reach out to students.
Do you remember what year that was?
I'm sorry?
Do you remember what year
that was? 1972. 1970, I graduated, and then in 72, graduating from Johns Hopkins, came back in August, and it was in the fall semester of 1972, we opened the brand new Office of Academic Services. And basically what we did is students would be assigned a schedule of classes, usually by their academic advisor. Students would have some choice in that. But as time went on through the 70s, students had major choice in that. They had to receive their advisor's signature. But there was something called a drop-add process, where if you wanted to drop a class in your schedule and add another one, you could do that. There was this $5 charge. You can imagine that in 1972. That was $5 was a lot of money. I mean, that was something you could go out to dinner on twice for $5. So, but students would drop a class and add it. And they were allowed 5 days at the beginning of the semester to drop a class and add another one or change the section of a class. Very clearly, many of the times that students dropped a class and added a class was because they thought Professor X was going to be too difficult or too demanding or just didn't match up with their persona. And so they wanted out of that class and they wanted into another class. So we set up that office, and the lead secretary was a woman by the name of Jean Richardson, who is long time retired. Jean was in the records office, the admissions office, and then the vice president for academic affairs office. Jean was a very bright, very, very hardworking young woman. And she was the frontline person in that academic services office. And then we would work with students who wanted to drop a class and add another class. And oftentimes students would say, well, I wanna drop this class, but I wanna add this class. And oftentimes you could understand they wanted to add the new class because their buddy was in the new class or their girlfriend was in the new class or someone they knew was in the new class. Well, our job was to make sure that when they dropped a class and added a new class, that the new class would actually count in their curriculum toward graduation requirements, that they weren't going to just drop and add and get into something that another year or so down the road, they would realize, well, wait a second, I can't even use that class toward fulfillment of my curricular requirements. So we, in a sense, were starting to do academic advisement. Now, in 1972, the APSCoF contract, APSCoF-PAHI was the union at the time, APSCoF for the association that we have today, but PAHI, representing the Pennsylvania Association of Higher Education, the first APSCoF faculty union members were part of also PAHI. So the APSCoF-PAHI contract referred to academic advisement as only a faculty responsibility. Well, I was actually a faculty member and assigned to an administrative post as assistant dean of men was the slot, but working in records and admissions. And so I was able to do that advisement for the students who wanted to alter their schedule. But if you can imagine, at that point in time in 1972, we had about 3,500 students or so. Almost every one of them wanted to change one class or more. Some wanted to change two or three classes. And you had 5 days to do this in and one place to do it. So Jean Richardson and other secretaries, Leona Porter was a wonderful person, Pamela Fadigan, a wonderful person, Jeannie Bruner was a wonderful, they would come in and we would attempt to serve the students. And on the left side of this computer printed card, the student would fill out the name of the course, the department number, a course number and section letter of what they wanted to drop. And they had to get a signature from the professor acknowledging they could drop the class. And then they would get the same information for the course they wanted to add on the right-hand side of the card. And $5. And they would come in, give the card and their $5 to one of the clerical members. They would turn around and enter the information on this massive machine called a CRT, cathode ray tube. It was the first effort at a microcomputer. It would not fit in a bushel basket. It was much larger than that. It on a desk, and you would process on this CRT the drop in the ad. And then you would turn to the student and say, okay, your card has been accepted. You were dropped out of this class. You're now in this class. And they would file their $5 into a secure area. We had a secure area that was actually the bottom of a file drawer. And we would, at different times of the day, collect the money. Two or more people would count the money and then take it upstairs to Alan McClyman's, who was the director of the business office or the manager of the business office. And you can imagine hundreds of students times $5, there's a lot of money there. And we were all very nervous as all that money would be secured out of the bottom of a file drawer and counted in the back room by two or three people and then carried upstairs. And so those 5 days were extremely busy. But what we learned in that is that we did not have to wait until a day or two before the semester begins to register a student for the semester. We ought to do it in advance. So we created something called advance registration. And by that, Joe Marks was the registrar and in charge of that. We would issue time cards to these 3,500 students, computer determined, over a period of about 3 to 4 weeks. And so you had 100 and some students per day over this period of 3 to 4 weeks. And they would come into the Academic Services Center and they would bring their registration form with all the courses they wanted signed by their advisor. And we would process that on the cathode ray tube monster. And so sooner or later, we realized, well, wait a second, we're actually, during one semester, we're changing grades from the previous semester. We're adjusting schedules of the current semester. We're registering students for the next semester, and we're taking information from the faculty for two semesters down the road of what was going to be taught. So in one semester, the Academic Services Office was working on four different semesters. Last semester, current semester, next semester, and the future semester down the road. So that was the beginning, frankly, of academic advisement on Slippery Rock's campus. It was the beginning of advanced registration. It was the beginning of students learning the curriculum and understanding their curriculum so well that they knew they could drop this class and add this class if it could still count toward graduation requirements. All of that kind of began in that very rudimentary Office of Academic Services. And that went on and developed more and more and more. And there were other services that were created out of that area, such as the Advisement Center, and faculty members hired to coordinate the Advisement Center. And probably the best known individual, I did that in a sense as part of my responsibility as an academic dean for a while, and then it just got too overwhelming. So we hired a young woman by the name of Amanda Yale to come in as the new director of the Advisement Center. And
oh, okay.
I mean, came in, and like many things that she's responsible for, she jump-started that responsibility to a new level. And thus, we have what we have today in terms of students understanding their curriculum, they're registering, they're changing their schedule, and so on and so forth.
Nice. So after that, you moved on to, what was the next position?
That's interestingly, I was the assistant registrar and assistant dean of men at that point in time, was the official title. And then Mr. Marks had a medical problem. And fortunately, he was able to recover from this, but it was going to be a few semesters until he was able to come back to work. So I then was assigned the responsibility of acting registrar, and also I was coordinator of the transfer student program. And in 1972, one of the first things we did with the transfer student program was I knew a gentleman by the name of Raymond Toman. And Ray Toman was the coordinator of transfer counseling at Butler County Community College. Butler County Community College opened as a brand new community college in 1966. And now in 1972, they're well underway, and there are a number of students graduating with associate degrees in different areas who want to go on to earn a baccalaureate degree. So Ray Toman was the coordinator of transfer programs. Well, I happened to attend the same church as Ray Toman, and we knew each other quite well for years. And after church, we would talk about, you know, we need to do something that's better for students, so that if they know in their freshman year and sophomore year at Butler County Community College that they're going to be transferring to Slippery Rock, they shouldn't wait until they get to Slippery Rock to find out how these courses at BC3 are going to be counted and used in their Slippery Rock curriculum. We ought to do something in advance for them. So Ray Toman and I sat down, and this would have been fall of 1972, spring of 1973. We sat down and we said, let's look at the elementary education track for Butler County Community College and what you require. And how does that fit into the Bachelor of Science degree in elementary education at Slippery Rock University? And we placed those courses, and we did what we didn't call it at that time, but that was actually the first articulation program between a community college and Slippery Rock University. And it started, frankly, with elementary education, one of the biggest programs, and secondary education. And the biggest program of all at that point in time was health and physical education teaching certification, which is now a small, much smaller program. But at that point in time, in the early to mid 70s, it was the elephant in the room. And nothing happened in significant ways without health and physical education department becoming involved. And the health and physical education department had a number of chair people. Bill Mizey was one, Brad Keith was one, Bill Herman was one. And then this young guy comes on as the department chairperson, Bob Abersold. And Bob Abersold and I sat down, and we said, wouldn't it be good if we did these articulation programs that we have developed with Butler County Community College and Community College of Allegheny County and Community College of Beaver County and Harrisburg Area Community College, because by that time, I had taken the dog and pony show to every community college that would sit long enough to listen. And we developed articulation with every community college from Harrisburg West and some even east in Pennsylvania.
Wow, but that must have been way ahead of its time.
It was way ahead of its time. And you know what, Kevin? We joked and used to say, and this is not the politically correct term, but we would joke and say Slippery Rock was eating the lunch of so many other campuses because we had these articulation programs. Now, this was long before laptops and iPads and smartphones. I mean, when I sat down to talk with the student about articulation, I would say, here it is. It's on one page. You'll see how your courses that you've taken fit into the Slippery Rock curriculum. But giving them that one page was huge. And then we kind of woke up the bear. The bear in Pennsylvania was the Pennsylvania State University. And it had a number of these branch campuses, like Greensburg and Barron to the north up in Erie, and so many different Mount Aloysius and all these branch campuses. And Penn State was teaching 800 level courses at these branch campuses, which meant, frankly, I didn't think it was a very fair thing, but it meant that the 800 level course could count toward an associate degree. But if you came to Penn State, we wouldn't count all those courses, even though we taught them to you at a Penn State branch campus. They weren't being counted toward a baccalaureate degree at Penn State main campus. And Bob Abersold and I said, that's not right. That's not right for students. So what we said is, I set up appointments to every branch campus on Penn State, and Slippery Rock went to Penn State branch campuses and said, all these 800 courses that you've taken, we'll take them. We'll accept them at Slippery Rock. And for about 3 or 4 years, we had dozens and dozens of Penn State undergraduate students coming to Slippery Rock to do their baccalaureate degree work because of this nonsense that Penn State taught these 800 level courses. Well, Penn State wised up on that, and they finally renumbered all their courses and accepted. But then Bob Abersold said to me as well, he said, you know, we're getting a lot of students from New York, and we're getting them from up in Herkimer County area, but we're getting them out in Long Island. We're even getting a lot of students from New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And we're getting some students from Maryland. So the dog and pony show went on the road again. And Bob, as chairperson of the health and physical education department, would sit down and talk with his counterpart at the community college. And I would place all the courses into the baccalaureate curriculum so that when we left, we had formed an articulation with each of those institutions. Many, many campuses that Bob had communicated with were out of state. And that was something unheard of. Keep in mind that we were a state-owned institution, and we were getting funding from the state House and Senate, the legislature, for assistance for primarily state residents. But non-residents were coming in and taking benefit of that as well. So that was a whole different issue in many ways. But the articulation effort, one of the reasons, if you take a look at how many transfer students Slippery Rock has even to this day. But if you go back into the late 70s, mid 80s, mid 90s, you will look at the number of transfer students that Slippery Rock has compared with an IUP or a California or a Clarion or an Edinburgh or Shippensburg. It doesn't matter. And perhaps Westchester would take as many, if not more. But Slippery Rock was taking, in many cases, 1,000 or more students in the fall semester as transfer students. Well, when you do that, then your freshman class does not have to be as large unless you want it to be. And that's why we were able to then grow our freshman class and grow transfer student
population.
And if you look at when Al Wattrell was the president back in the 70s, late 60s, from 68 to 76, he wanted the institution to be large. And we grew a great deal during that time. And even after Al Wattrell's era, we went from that 2,500-ish in the mid to late 1960s. I think when I graduated in 1970, there were somewhere around 3,000, 3,100 students. Well, we went from 3,000 to 7,500.
Wow.
In not very many years. And it was because young people pursuing higher education and not just the traditional 17 to 18 to 19 new freshmen, but it was the older students who were coming in as well. We welcomed all of those older students going to associate degree granting institutions because they were married and had children, or they were married and had a job, and they could only take one or two courses at the local community college. There was Slippery Rock with open arms, and they came here in large numbers as well. So that was kind of the beginning way back with Ray Toman and Butler County Community College.
Nice. Is that when you became an academic president after that, or how did that work out?
After I was the interim registrar or acting registrar and so on and so forth, it was after that period of being active registrar that I was assigned increased responsibilities, and I became the assistant dean for, initially it was called Special Academic Programs. And that was admissions, records, advisement, the Act 101 state grant programs, the federal TRIO grant programs, and some other areas, orientation as well. Moving from assistant dean of special academic programs to then later with more responsibility, associate dean of graduate and special programs, and then eventually to dean of academic services, and then that name changed to first year programs. And first year programs was everything that went into a student's life as a first year student. From the time they were admitted, they were oriented, they were advised, they were registered, they were tutored, if they were in a state or federal grant program. But we began to, and that's at the time, Amanda Yale was in the advisement area. We began talking more and more about, we had a large number of freshmen coming as freshmen who would enroll for their first and second semester, but then they would not stay on as sophomores. And we even had some transfer students, which is even more difficult because these students were really upperclassmen when they were coming to us. Not many, but we did have some who would do a semester, two semesters, and then withdraw. And we began to ask why. Why are these young people who are very capable, very talented, very well qualified, why are they not staying to graduate? And the answers we got over the next 5 to 10 years were answers that surprised a lot of people. Some would be financial reasons. They simply could not afford. But rather than sitting down and talking with a counselor about my financial aid has changed, or my father lost his job, my mother lost her job, or my parents are separated and now my financial base is less than it was, or these changes in a young person's life, instead of their communicating that to us, they simply, in many cases, were a bit embarrassed by all of that and just withdrew. So we began to be what we referred to as assertive advisors. We began to be intrusive advisors. We had an academic advisement center, a tutorial center, a financial aid center that wanted to know why. And anytime we could assist the student with the life-changing situation they were going through, we did that. Now, that began an entirely new set of services to students, services outside the classroom, services that we realized young women were having difficulties that young men the same age or the same curriculum or the same geographic background were not having. We found out it was veterans who were having difficulties in one way or another in completing the degrees. What we found when we formed this whole area of first year studies, F-Y-R-S-T, FIRST stands for first year studies. And what we tried to do is track that student from the time they applied for admission, through acceptance, through orientation, through their first semester, through their second semester, and into the sophomore year, where they would be successful academically, they would be successful socially, because what our data was showing and our research was showing, and there was a gentleman by the name of John Gardner down at the University of South Carolina who had this whole massive first year studies research project. And what he was showing people, not just in the United States, but across the world, was students will stay at your university if and only if their needs are met. And some of those needs are academic, but some of them are not academic. Some of them are financial. Some of them are social. Some of them are engagement. We realized early on that if we had a student who was involved in 2 or 3 academic clubs or social clubs, student government, athletics, their marching band, if they were involved, those students persisted at Slippery Rock to graduation at a much higher percentage rate than the students who did not get connected. And so this whole issue of connectivity came into play. And so my good fortune was I just happened to be here and be interested and want to be involved in the lives of students as an academic dean, where other academic deans we're working directly with faculty and curriculum and so on and so forth, the very important in-classroom activities. I was working with faculty and staff on what we were learning as the very important out-of-classroom activities, which probably in the same capacity, if not more, connected that student to Slippery Rock University and kept them here. So after that, my opportunity to serve as dean of first year studies, that takes me up to about 1999. And it was a Friday afternoon, late afternoon, 5:30, 6 o'clock. And I had the habit, my management style was come in early, get everything prepped for the day so that I could spend the day having meetings with faculty, staff, and students. At the end of the day, I would stay until I got everything wrapped up so that I didn't have to start the next day with a great backlog. But it was Friday and I was wanting to get home, begin the weekend and so on. And heard the knock on, I was in the Lowry Center. That was my office in the second floor. Heard a knock on the door downstairs. And I thought, well, someone must need help or something. It's 5:30, 6 o'clock. And I went down to the front door and opened it. And here's Warren Smith, G. Warren Smith, who is the president. And I said, oh, hi, Dr. Smith, come on in. What can I help you with? And he said, do you have a few minutes? I'd like to talk with you. Now, when the president says that on Friday late afternoon, when no one else is around, you think, is this a good thing or is this not a good thing?
Right.
He came up to the office and took off his coat and scarf and hat. And he said, I had a surprise occur this afternoon. And he said it took me off guard, actually. I was not expecting anything like that. And I'd like to share it with you. Okay. He said, our vice president for student affairs, and then he named her, has accepted a job as vice chancellor for student affairs at the University of Pittsburgh. A very demanding job. But she's going to leave in 3 weeks. And we need a vice president for student affairs. Well, you know, I worked a lot with the Division of Student Affairs as an academic dean that was engaged directly with students. We worked a lot together. Orientation had actually been with the Division of Student Affairs for several years until Bob Abersold transferred it to me in academic affairs and academic services because he wanted more of an academic influence into the engagement of orientation. So I worked with a lot of the student affairs people and I worked with the housing staff on a regular basis. I worked with the counseling staff on a regular basis. And I said, okay, well, you have a few people in that division who are very responsible people, I'm sure, and they've been at higher levels in the division. And are you looking at those people to move in to that? He said, well, he said, that's the situation I'm dealing with. He said, I think you would be the best choice to serve as the interim vice president for student affairs. And you could have knocked me off the chair. I said, Dr. Smith, I'm in the academic affairs division. I understand that. And I said, well, I'm an academic dean and I understand that. He said, but I don't think there's anyone on this campus who puts students first like you do. And I want that attitude in that division. He said, now, I'm not going to make you do this. I'm not going to reassign you into a position that you would not want to serve in. But I'm going to ask you to go home and talk with Karen and your family. Because even though this would be an acting position, I would ask you to assume this position for a year while we study what we want as a vice president, how that vice president should be engaged with the president's cabinet and the other vice presidents, and what we want for the future. And Warren Smith had done, by that point in time, a project referred to as Future Watch in the 1990s and into the early 2000s. And Future Watch was this comprehensive review of Slippery Rock University, somewhat in the past, definitely in the present, but also largely for the future. It was a master plan in a sense, but for all areas, not just the bricks and mortar or the physical plan. It was a master plan for everything. And so he said, I'd like to know what this division wants to do in the future and wants to be. And I'd like you to seriously consider that. And if you don't think that's what you want to do, I will respect that. So I went home and I was probably 10 feet in the room when my wife said, what is wrong? What's going on? And I said, I just had a conversation with the president. And she pulled the chair out in the kitchen and she said, I think we better talk about this. But it was, for me, an affirmation of what I was doing with students and the attitude I had towards students. It was, students are the most important element in a university. And long story short, I accepted the interim position, the acting position. President Smith stopped over several times over the period of the next 8 or 9 months. And I distinctly remember it was probably about 8 months into this that he stopped over one late afternoon again. Only this time I was in 304 Old Main, right beside the president's office, and he stopped over after everybody else had gone for the day. And he said, so how do you like the job? And I said, it's demanding. It's long hours. It's rewarding. And he said, well, good. That's good. I'm glad you're challenged by it. I'm glad you're rewarded by it. He said, I hear some very positive things in the division by people who really hadn't been very positive in the past. So he said, yeah, whatever you're doing, keep it up and keep me informed and thank you very much. And I thought, you know, the one thing I asked President Smith to sign for me, or to give me before I accepted the interim position, was a statement that guaranteed me my position as dean of first year studies at the end of the year. I didn't want to get into a situation where, and it was Amanda Yale and Elliot Baker who had jointly accepted responsibilities, and even Champ Storch and Will Haddon had been involved in accepting their responsibilities as well. So I wanted to be able to go back to that position because I really had no thought whatsoever of moving from academic affairs to student affairs. And they had announced a position opening, the new vice president for student affairs, and they were receiving applications and nominations. And we were about a month, I guess, before the close of applications. And I had an appointment on my calendar at the end of the day, I think a 5 o'clock appointment. And what I usually did when I was the vice president was I held between 8 and 5 the meetings I had to hold with faculty and staff and the president's cabinet and the academic deans and others. And then in the evening, I spent time visiting student organizational meetings, committee meetings, SGA meetings, hall council meetings, the police meetings in the evening, because I was responsible for university police as well. So I spent that time doing those meetings. So it was about 5 o'clock and I was getting ready to go out and do some meetings. And it was on my calendar. All it said was staff. And I thought, oh, that's odd. So 5 o'clock came and an entourage of several staff members, probably 20 or 25, began to walk into the office. And I thought, I jokingly said, okay, if this is a coup, you can just have the place. I'll see you later. And the group came in and they said, we'd like to read a memo that we've written and addressed to Robert Smith, who was the vice president for academic affairs, but he was also chair of the search committee for VP for student affairs. And the staff read this letter to Bob Smith that said they were nominating me for the permanent position. And the one gentleman who's still employed here said to me, and frankly, we don't care what you think about this. We just want you to apply for the job. And I had not at that point in time, and frankly, had not even pulled together a resume or anything like that. I just was ready to move back to my deanship, and that was going to be fine. And I figured another 5 years as the academic dean or so on, and then I was going to retire. But my life changed dramatically then when I went through the application process. It was a little odd, very strange, going through an application process on your home campus and answering a series of questions and interviews and so on along the way. And then it got to the final 5, and then it got to the final 3. And the final 3 were invited on campus for 2 days of persistent interviews. And I was in several situations, Kevin, over those 2 days of meetings where I almost wanted to say, you know me. I've been here 30 years. You ask me this question, and I would hope by now, you know Bob Watson well enough to answer the question. But I never did that. I took it very seriously and with a great deal of responsibility, and went through those 2 days of interviews. And when Warren Smith came over and offered me the job, it was absolutely one of the most rewarding times of my life, and only surpassed by what was then the next 7 years as opportunity to serve students at Slippery Rock University as their vice president, their chief advocate, as I saw it. So that got me to that point.
Nice. And how long were you in that position?
I was in that position from 2000 to 2006. I retired in 2006. Then I got a call from Bob Smith, who was the president at that time. And I got a call in 2007 that the vice president for university advancement did not have a contract continued. And Bob Smith asked if I would come back and serve as interim vice president for advancement if Bob Abersold would be willing to assist and in that effort. And I said, Bob Abersold is one of my favorite people in life. So anytime I had an opportunity to work with Bob Abersold, I said, sure, Bob Abersold's willing to tolerate me. Boy, I'd love to work with him. So Bob Smith assigned us the responsibility, and Bob Abersold came to me after I had agreed and said, okay, I have to tell you, I really don't have a lot of time to be doing the day-to-day office management. So I'd like you to be the day-to-day VP for advancement and work with the staff, work with the faculty, and so on and so forth, work with the university. And he said, I'll be willing to make some calls on individuals for major gifts and fundraising. And that was wonderful. So I did the day-to-day office stuff and did some major fundraising and made solicitations as well, and so on and so forth. But that was supposed to be for 2 or 3 months or so. And I guess it was about 8 or 9 months until they then hired the new the vice president for university advancement. And she came in and just moved right into the office just fine. So then I retired again, and that was 2008. And I was retired for about 4 years. And we had a new president, Bob Smith, retired. And we had a new president come on, Cheryl Norton, our first woman president. And we were so glad to see Cheryl come on. And I was one of the thousands of people, I'm sure, who met her over the first few months of her experience as a brand new president. I remember meeting Cheryl the very first time when they had a welcome for her at North Hall. And Karen and I attended as individuals involved with the community and involved with the university and retired faculty, staff, and so on and so forth. And I shook her hand and welcomed her to Slippery Rock.
right along with the several hundred others who came through the line. So I am absolutely certain she had no idea who I was any more than any of the others. Although one thing that Cheryl did tell me later, she did put my name with a face and a book. And that was when Cheryl became president, I sent her a copy of the university's history before she even came to Slippery Rock, when she was still at Connecticut, Southern Connecticut. And I said, this is not necessarily light reading, but the good thing is there will be no quiz. But I said, I just thought you would enjoy understanding the past, the rich tradition, the rich history of the institution you are now going to be serving as its president. And I wrote a little note to her and sent that well before she came. And she told me later that she actually, when I came through the line, she said, I knew there was a reason why I should remember Bob Watson's name. But it wasn't until I went home and saw the book and put it all together. So the next time I met Cheryl Norton was at an athletic fundraiser. And we were there. And again, it was, I believe it was the women's athletic golf outing that I was attending, which I attended regularly for many years. And Cheryl was there to greet everybody. And I shook her hand again and so on and so forth. And that was my understanding of Cheryl Norton until I got a phone call, and got a phone call from an individual who had just spoken with the president, and that individual said that the president had not renewed the contract of the vice president for student affairs, and the president was interested in knowing if I would have interest in coming back to serve for a semester in the role that I had filled for several years. And I said, I'd like to have conversation with the president about that. If there's interest on her part, I would like to know her perspective before there would be any interest on my part. And so Cheryl and I got together and we talked, and I understood then better why the contract of the previous VP was not continued. And I knew the environment in which the division was. And I also knew that at that point in time, there were at least two or three people in the division who expected to be named interim vice president for student affairs. And the president did not want to make that appointment. So she said, I would like you to come back if you're willing to serve your alma mater, if you're willing to serve this institution you've already served for so many years, if you're willing to serve for another 6 months, I would greatly appreciate that. And so, much to the surprise of a number of the people in the division, when she announced that Bob Watson was coming out of retirement to serve in that position, I'm sure there were a lot of people who were surprised, some who were probably shocked, and some who probably didn't want to see me because they really felt they should be in that interim role. But all in all, it went, I think, extremely well, except, as I said to Cheryl Norton, after 14 months in the position, I said, you know, I like retirement. I really thought it was a good thing. And you told me 6 months. It's now been 14 months. I need to go back to retirement. And so we Cheryl and I joked about that. And then I left after 14 months. I believe it was 2013 or the beginning of 14 there, somewhere in that area that I left and had the good fortune of that last year as interim. We hired in the cooperative activities operation a woman by the name of Wendy Letera. And Wendy was an internal auditor and accountant, consultant, and so on in private business. And we hired her to come in as business manager. And that was absolutely one of my best decisions to hire Wendy to come in. And she continues to be just outstanding with regard to Student Government Association, the bookstore, the Happy Bus, the Child Care Center and co-op. But the reason I bring that in is Wendy had reconciled with the Board of Governors at the state level our affiliated entity position. And we had always had a separate 501c3 organization for student government, but it was never recognized officially as an affiliated entity because the Board of Governors had a separate process by which you needed to go through. The Alumni Association had gone through it, the foundation had gone through it, but SGA had not gone through it. And so that process was completed, and we then needed a board of directors for the Student Government Association. And I was asked to serve on the board of directors, which I currently serve. And for the first few years, I was blessed to be able to serve as chairperson of that good group. So I continue to be kind of connected to the institution in that regard, certainly. Not in a paid, in any paid manner. So,
You know, you mentioned your book, and I wanted to just show people the cover of it here. It's fantastic resource for us in the archives, and I recommend it highly to anybody that's just remotely interested in the history of Slippery Rock. It's fantastic. It's a great book to go to. And it covers the whole era from the normal school era all the way up to the university. And I'm guessing you did it for your doctorate. Your thesis.
Correct. I, from 72 to 79, I did the initial research for what was my dissertation, which was Slippery Rock State College, the legend behind the name. I then ended up publishing that in 1982 in a softback edition, all black and white photographs. That was my dissertation plus about 3 years of additional work to create it into a book format. And the book that you have then, Kevin, is Slippery Rock University, The Legend Behind the Name. And what happened was I actually never stopped researching in 82. My love for the history of the university kept me interested and engaged. And so I became an eBay junkie in the 1980s, 1990s, and into the early 2000s. And anything that came up on eBay, I would, if I could possibly afford it, and I would buy it. I didn't care if it was a postcard, if it was a box of minutia that some family had found in the attic of their great grandmother or great aunt or whatever. I was interested in looking at all of that. I went out and communicated with every auctioneer in Western Pennsylvania, actually, and said, if you come out upon anything that says Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania, Slippery Rock Normal School, Slippery Rock State Teachers College, here's my business card. Call me. I will come to the auction and I will bid and probably buy it. And I bought hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces of Slippery Rock historical memorabilia, most of which now reside in Slippery Rock University archives. And frankly, Kevin, I mean, thanks to you and thanks to Judy, our archives is something to be extremely proud of. It is something that when you come in this facility, and I understand there's limitations with the pandemic and so on, but that will pass. When you come into this archives, you are blessed with living the history. And whether it's photographs or whether it's costumes of Rocky One or Rocky Two, or whether it's information about Emma Gottfried Miller or information regarding any of the presidents, many of the faculty, many of the alumni, there's an opportunity to come in here and learn in a way that I did not have. Unfortunately, when I started in 1972 at Pitt and researching, I can remember going to the University of Pittsburgh Library, going to Carnegie Mellon Library, and there was nothing, nothing. And then finally, finding that many of the original minutes of the stockholders organization, or then later on the Council of Trustees, resided partly in the president's office, sometimes in the library, sometimes in the alumni association. I mean, it was here, there, and everywhere, and it was not coordinated. It was not in a manner in which someone could come in and begin to do research. And you and Judy have done all of that. We have something here that is a jewel of the campus, a jewel of the university. As everyone has heard, I'm sure, you can never fully understand the present or the future unless you begin to understand the past. And so what you have created is just wonderful. And I would encourage anyone who watches this and so many others to come to the third floor of Bailey Library and roll up your sleeves and be ready to be enlightened in this university's history, culture, values, and traditions.
Yeah, it's a unique story I've really learned to appreciate. And thank you so much, Bob. Thanks. Well, thank you. We appreciate all you've donated to us. And thank you for doing this interview, too.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Okay. Now we'll call that the end of it then. Unless you have anything else you want to add?
If I could get on record, while I think of it here, our family has been blessed with the ability to have five generations involved with Slippery Rock. And I made reference to my great-grandfather, John N. or Nelson Watson, and he was one of the original stockholders, one of the early members of the Board of Trustees. He was also building chairperson, building construction manager of the West Gym. He also was a stonemason, and the lions that flanked the entrance into West Hall are some of my great-granddad's work. And then his son, his oldest son, Grover Watson, graduated from the normal school in 1913, a man I never, unfortunately, I never got a chance to meet my granddad. He passed away before I was born, but he had, he went on from Slippery Rock Normal School, where he studied math and science. He went to the University of Pittsburgh to the school to get his baccalaureate degree, and then on to the School of Pharmacy. And he opened a pharmacy, a general store, and so on, right across from West Hall, Carruth Rizzo Hall, what is now Big Shot Bob's Wings. But that store on the corner there of Main Street and the alley that runs there between the post office and the store was where my granddad had his store. And he was well known to a lot of the students in the high school, because that was West Hall was the high school. So the high school kids would come over to his store at various times, and to the normal school and State Teachers College. Well, then it was his oldest son, Grover, and Florence Watson's oldest son, John Watson, who enrolled in 1934 for 2 years, ran out of money, and went to Elwood City to work in the tube mill in the steel industry. For 2 years, he lived with his grandmother in Wurttemberg and earned enough money in those 2 years to come back to Slippery Rock in 1938 and ultimately, they can graduate in 1940. And John Austin Watson then was my dad. I want to say one thing about my grandmother, Florence Hines Watson. My grandma was very proud to be affiliated with this institution. And in a capacity that is not perhaps as prestigious as being a professor, as being a dean, as being a faculty member. But my grandma washed clothes and pressed clothes of students in what was the washroom of the normal school. And that was actually in a building which would be situated, if it were there today, right between Behavioral Science Building, Strain Behavioral Science Building, and Weisenflew Cafeteria or Dining Hall. Right on the road, as there's a little alley that goes down to a parking lot, off the main campus loop there, that building was the facilities building. It was a tiny little thing that kept, housed tools and so on and so forth. But in that area was also the washing area. And so my grandma was a washwoman and washed and ironed the clothes for the students in the normal school. They would bring the clothes to that area and have them washed. And she loved that job. And that then moved to the basement of the Behavioral Science Building, a Strain, for a while. And she continued. And that was very hard work. They had, at that time, they had old washing machines that were called Wrangles. And you could get your hands or fingers caught in those and lose an appendage. And it was, you worked with lye soap and all of those kinds of things that just were far in the rudimentary process of washing clothes. But in the 1960s, my grandma, they closed down the washroom, and she was going to lose her job. but it was her supervisor who identified that my grandmother always saw the glass as half full. And I was blessed as the oldest grandson to have the opportunity to be the one responsible in the family to take care of my grandma's lawn, her shrubbery, her walks, her garden. And whether it was summer or winter, that was my responsibility as the oldest grandson. So I got to know my grandma very well. And when she was given the job to be house mother in Harner Hall, she thought that was the best job in the world. She said, well, yeah, they want you to keep the hall clean. And sure, you dust and you mop and you clean and you wax and you buff and that. But you're doing it right there with all the students. And they're so nice. Those girls are so nice. And I have talked to several Slippery Rock alumni who, women who lived in Harner Hall when my grandma was a house mother there. And they thought the world of Mrs. Watson, and she thought the world of them. So it was grandma and granddad's oldest son, John, my dad, who graduated in 40. And then I came along and started in 66 and graduated in 70, and then worked from 72 until off and on then to 2014, I guess. And then our youngest daughter, Emily Elizabeth Watson, our first daughter, Kate, went to Penn State, and she wanted a large public institution. She wanted pre-med, and she loved her experience at Penn State. She's now a physician at Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh. And Laura didn't want large public. She chose something very different. Our middle daughter, Laura Jean Watson, chose to go to West Point. And she accepted her nomination and served in the military and was discharged, and then had the opportunity to serve in a number of governmental related agencies. And then now is at Westinghouse and is a senior manager there, and got to do what she wanted to do in life. And Emily Elizabeth, if she were here today, she would tell you that she was the smartest of the three daughters, because whereas the oldest one chose Penn State, the middle one chose West Point. Yeah, you've heard of those institutions maybe, but she was the smartest one because she chose the best known institution of all, and that's Slippery Rock University. So Emily got to live her dream in coming to Slippery Rock. One of the elements of her dream was being homecoming queen, which she was in 2006, and then graduated in the spring of 2007. So she's our fifth member of the Watson family to either graduate or be involved. And of course, my wife, Karen, I met at Slippery Rock University. So it can't get any better than that. Karen graduated in 1973.
Nice. Yeah. That's great. Wonderful story.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm working on another group of memorabilia to be forwarding on to you here soon, Kevin.
Okay, great. And if anybody's listening to this, we just welcome anyone to come by. Of course, you know, we're in the middle of this pandemic, so it makes it a little difficult, but once this passes, and we're so much open to anybody coming in from the public, students especially, if they want to do some research, primary research. So thanks for all your help and generosity over the years, donating material, you and Karen. So
if there is a student who can learn from my mistakes in life, and there have been many, if they can learn to be a better student, from my mistakes, if they can learn to be a better person from my mistakes, if they can learn in any way related to the archives of this institution, through which Karen and I have great pleasure in supporting, we would be elated to know that someone has learned as a result of that. So don't let something like the pandemic keep you from being further enlightened in the university.
Well, we have a digital presence too. So we have online displays, the history of the university, also the oral histories, which this will be part of. And we can make arrangements if someone wants to come by even during this, you know, difficult time. So they get in touch with us. They can get in touch with us on the webpage. Judy still is presenting classes even by Zoom, but we either scan the material or digitize it somehow and make it accessible to students. So we've had different disciplines take, we've collaborated with different majors and it's worked out. It's been great.
Good.
Great experience, yeah.
Thank you again, Kevin.
All right, thank you.